This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We have reached longtime radio producer Mariah Gallardin in Northern California. She's the host of TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness has been on the air for a very long time. It originates in San Francisco, and it is syndicated to other stations. Over the years, we have played several of Mariah's pieces on Radio EcoShock. Hello, Mariah. How is it going where you are?
Hi, Alex. It's smoky here, as you might have guessed.
Yeah. So in a quick email exchange, you talked about being worried of toxins in the fire smoke that's even getting indoors right into your living room. What are you concerned about?
The most recent fire, the tragic fire that's still going on, that burned down a whole town, the whole town of Paradise, 100 miles north from here, where over 7,000 homes went up in flames and many cars. That's been by far the most toxic-looking fire. As you may know, we had two of the biggest fires in the last 2 years right outside my door, the Redwood Valley fire in October 2017 and the Mendocino Complex fire that began in July 2018. And those fires were mostly vegetation fires. So when we did fire watch here from our high point on the ranch, we would sit there and see the white plumes of smoke coming up beyond the next ridge line. And every now and then the plume turned black, and we know now from experience that's when a home went up in flames or a vehicle. And this particular cloud coming down from Paradise that lasted for a week, that was black from the very beginning. You probably all have seen the photos of it.
They're terrible photos. I've collected a few because I never thought I'd see something like that. And as you say, modern homes are filled with chemicals and heavy metals and the building materials and the cars and the electronics and the paints. And now all we see at Paradise is a dust pile, really, punctuated with twisted steel and bits of concrete. What had to happen in Redwood Valley before they could rebuild there?
In Redwood Valley, to my surprise, no house was allowed to be rebuilt unless it was investigated for toxins, and in some cases, like 1 to 2 feet layers of the dirt around the house and in the perimeter foundation, if it wasn't a cement slab, had to be removed. And when I was surprised to see the list of toxins that they were looking for, people said to me, well, your house is made of straw and clay, so that's not very toxic. But what about your solar system? What about your batteries? What about the lead in your batteries? So I am not really living a toxin-free environment either. And I also have to have actually 2 cars to get in and out of here. 1 car that's a 4-wheel drive that gets me through my 3 miles of dirt road when it's raining or when there are landslides, and a smaller car that I use when I have to go to San Francisco. So cars are amazingly toxic themselves. If you look at the photos from Paradise more closely, you see these wrecked cars and you see huge frozen puddles of aluminum, as it turns out, when the motor block melted.
It's astounding stuff. And then, Mariah, when we lose a home, maybe we can rebuild, but when a whole community is wiped out like Paradise was, it's hard to imagine. Can it ever be the same?
No. Many of these people don't even know how to rebuild because Paradise was a low-income community and hardly anybody had fire insurance, and the whole infrastructure burned up too. This is actually a new problem. We are hearing from the adjacent cities of Oroville and Chico that they're now facing, having to absorb the population. That's 27,000 residents that are now homeless.
Wow.
And they're currently, there are not even enough shelters for everybody, so there are tent cities going up on parking lots to serve as temporary shelter. And those who were lucky enough to escape in their cars, for instance, a friend of mine who used to work for a local radio station here, she almost didn't make it out in her car. She had about 5 minutes when she realized the world was burning around her to just throw a few things into her car, including her guitar. They're often so moving items people pick up. And I've done that too a couple of times. I was evacuated. Later I thought, why did I pick that? So she got into a huge line of vehicles trying to escape that was in an enormous traffic jam. So the sheriff came by and said, you're faster on foot. And she, in spite of flames now licking at the road from both sides, got out of the car and started walking. And then all of a sudden it started moving again, so she rushed back to her car and was the third to last vehicle that escaped. Some people have their cars to live in, but that's about all.
We've had this locally in the city of Grand Forks, which is the next town to me. They had a levee break in the floods this summer, and there was flooding. A whole part of the community was wiped out. The provincial, or what you would call state government, promised a lot of money and aid. We've got your backs, the premier said when he came to visit, but in fact, nothing has really come through. We've got people who are living in RVs that they try and put skirting around the tires or something, but they're not winterized at all, and the homeless situation is terrible. It's really developed that way. But you've raised another problem, and that is whether to get out in your car. And strangely, after the Black Saturday bushfires, I want to tell you a story. In 2009, the Australian government changed their position on staying to fight fires. So many Australians died in their cars trying to get out. And so the government suggested, well, maybe you could stay if that's what you want to do. And there was a similar situation in 2017 in Portugal. 62 people died in their cars fleeing a fire. It's really confusing, Mariah. I mean, personally, if fires come to my place, I'm going to try and get out quick. We have documents and bug out bags, and we've got bins to load some crap on a pickup truck if we have to. I don't know. What's your plan?
You are totally right about that. A car can save you, and a car can be your trap. And I observed that too. My personal plan is I'm looking at a mowed area that once a year when the wildflowers are done blooming, I have it mowed with a tractor. And I can't tell you the size of it, but it takes this tractor about an hour to mow the area. And it's fairly well maintained because it's being mowed at the beginning of the summer when nothing grows anymore. And that's my fire-safe zone. I offered it to neighbors, too, to come into. And we had a helicopter land on it on one occasion because it's very mountainous, the terrain here. So this is a rare flat spot. And my plan was beginning in 2008, actually, when I first had to fight the first fire here, my plan is to bring two cars into the center of the fire safe zone, load it with water, and then stay there and defend my house. Because many, many times the spotting and wind throw of embers and little branches could have been prevented from turning into fire if somebody had been there, even just with a bucket and a burlap bag and maybe an Indian pump sprayer or a backpack sprayer. I heard many examples of people who have done that and saved the house, even in paradise. Can you imagine that inferno? A couple of people stayed and had little 5-gallon buckets and put out flames around the house. So that's the plan. But I took note of those changes in policy in Australia, too, because in the 2008 lightning fire here, we were told by the fire department in no uncertain terms that if we were asked to evacuate, we had to leave because we were endangering others by staying, because I don't know if the policy is the same in Canada, but the fire department has to save lives first and then property. Although the way they array themselves, you often think that's maybe not always true, because property, of course, is of high value in this society. But we were told, if you do this, you endanger others. So it's a real dilemma. And the only reason this real dilemma was broken in a way was the 2008 fires that were my first fires. And they were called the lightning complex fires because they were set by a flurry of lightning that occurred in the middle of the night, woke me up. I saw the trees around me illuminated by this flash, bright blue light. And these lightning fires set over 100 fires here in Mendocino alone. So the fire department had more than they could handle. And eventually they brought in troops from all over the western states. These fires went on for a month. So what we had to do here, we had to do our own firefighting. We could see where the lightning has struck. We went up there with trucks, with containers of water, like 300-gallon containers. Some people on the ranch here had little Honda pumps. And we joined the overall effort of creating fire lines. We helped the bulldozers. We put out fires that were smoldering. You probably have seen that, too. The tree looks as if it's out, but then you realize it's hollow in the inside and it's a little smoke rising from it.
Right, or the roots are on fire.
Yes. We fought fires here for 4 weeks as amateurs. We learned a lot.
And you know, another problem that we're going to see more and more with climate change is evacuation fatigue. I read that the town of Paradise was given 4 evacuation orders in the last 10 years, so some people just don't believe in it. And the same thing when a hurricane strikes, you know, you get the hurricane warning and then, oh, it moved away from the coast. It wasn't so bad. So the next time they get the warning to evacuate and they stay, and some lose their lives because of that. So that evacuation fatigue is another problem that we're going to have to face.
You know what my experience is, you really have to keep the preparation and the organizing up. Maybe in 2008, people wouldn't believe that it would get worse. But by now, pretty much everybody around me, including Trump supporters, they shake their heads when he says, oh, climate change is a joke, because they see it in their cattle. They see it in their agriculture. They see it in their vineyards. They experience it, and that experience is much more important than any Fox News pronouncements. So everybody is aware of this becoming worse and worse. And in addition to that, you know, if you're counting the size and seriousness of the fires, just here for my community in Mendocino County, we had the worst in terms of size and the worst in terms of destruction directly affect us here. So people are organizing to do things because neighbors can help neighbors. In many cases, that's the only thing that will help you, because it happens too fast or it happens on such a large scale that the people who are professionally obligated to deal with it just can't handle it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, here with California radio host Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio at tucradio.org. Mariah, the stock price crash for California electricity provider PG&E. That follows reports that problems from their power lines may have started at least one of these deadly mega fires. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, I have. And I just reissued a program I recorded in 96. And the person I interviewed then was naming automobiles and power lines as the two main ignition sources to worry about in the forest restoration project he was working on in Mountain Grove. And there were more examples of high power lines igniting. It's maybe too early to call the Paradise campfire for that, but there was a fire under transmission lines. And PG&E is sort of arguing, well, we don't really know if we started the fire or if the fire started the breakdown of our transmission line. But I saw photos of that initial blast that the Paradise, Town of Paradise Fire Department tried to deal with. And it was strangely stretched long, as if something happened along between two pylons along the transmission line. Actually, maybe I shouldn't be saying this. I'm speculating. But I should talk about the Redwood Valley fire that started last year in October 2017. And that was clearly laid to PG&E, as well as the fires that started around Santa Rosa around the same time. And, you know, you can just look into the CAL FIRE or whoever is your local fire agency, and they list the sources. So they often say power lines. They say power lines, automobiles. They say lightning, which is, surprised me when I looked it up, that lightning still causes about 50% of the fires, but not necessarily the ones that were most severe. There's only one home that burned in the 129 fires that were caused by lightning in 2008. And, you know, Native Americans dealt with lightning fires with ease, and they had no helicopters or fire bombers or fire departments. Those fires usually are relatively mild when they start. They hit a tree, and you can rush and extinguish it before it spreads with minimal technology.
You just produced an updated version of your mini-documentary about Native American forest practices. Tell us about that, and can we learn a lot from the original inhabitants of the West?
Yes, that was, I think we can. And when I first produced it in 96, I was hoping people were to look at the Western forests, the California West forests, and see what was once there and how it could be gotten back. The forests that the settlers found in the early 1800s, or the Spanish conquistadors or church people who came up from Mexico, were extraordinarily open. They had about 15 trees per acre in the Mountain Grove area, where Dennis was counting trees, and now there are a few thousand per acre. They had these beautiful, big, old-growth trees that were not considered a lumber source. They were considered a food source or just a home. And the openness of those forests made the conquistadors say, this is like a park. We can ride our horses right through here, not knowing that their hoofs were treading on carefully tended root gardens that they didn't recognize because there weren't any fences around them. But the Native American forestry here was highly involved in the well-being of the forest. Dennis Martinez was crediting Native American women for setting these small burns. That was the technology they were using. Small, soft burns that hardly ever got out of hand, that were burning for the acorn crops to keep the acorn trees healthy because that was food. They were burning for the basket plants because those were the cooking and storage implements that were needed, and not just even one, like willow or hazelnut. If you look at the Native American baskets from this area, there were dozens and dozens of sources of brush and bush that were used in those baskets. And the landscape was gently modified to produce home and shelter. So now, if the women who did this burning up to the mid-1800s, when it was outlawed by settlers and led to the totally overgrown junky forests we have now, they wouldn't recognize the forests they want. And the reason I put this program back out was to give some inspiration to people who realize that bringing back fire is actually a wise idea, but they don't always do it the right way. I mean, there was just a controlled burn 2 weeks ago, 16 miles north from here, that got out of hand in spite of fire department standing by. I don't know what they did. I mean, they run around with these little flamethrowers to get things going.
I've been following a guy, he's a professor, David Swain, I think his name is. He's in Weather West is his Twitter handle. And he's been putting up maps about how the fire season has been growing longer and longer, and basically said that if the rains that normally, in quotation marks, came in November had arrived before these recent fires, they probably wouldn't have happened, or certainly wouldn't have happened to the horrific extent that they did, and that the plants were just so dried out that they're all tinder. And then we add into that people building their homes in canyons with just one road in or out, and a lot of population expansion in California. It seems like a bad mix with climate change and more people in that beautiful state.
That's true. We had one rain so far. We often get some rain in this area in October. There's nothing in the forecast. We had half an inch, and we're hoping for more rain between November and March, but it's not sure that's going to happen in any large quantity.
Right. How long has TUC Radio been on the air?
Almost a quarter century.
Just for people who don't know, what can people expect to find on your show?
No, recently I have done more climate change, although I never miss any of your shows. I find that the service you render is really extraordinary, but it's sort of a civic responsibility to cover it, especially since hardly anybody else does. Although it's kind of curious, California is different in some ways. There's actually a state office. That's OEHHA. It's the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment. And they have a very interesting, wide-ranging climate change assessment page. And if you're asking yourself, why is it so dry? Why is it so windy? Why are the rains coming so late? Why are the rivers and lakes so warm here? Why are the coastal waters so warm as well? How is acidity rising in those? That's actually all kept track of. Also, the famous snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, that's what's being measured by this office. And you see a picture for the last, especially the last few years, of conditions that are rising that enable fire. Dryness, trees dying from the heat. We had 129 million fir trees die in California between 2012 and 2017. And those are standing dead for the most part, an inviting source for fires.
We have the same situation in British Columbia. The pine beetle killed off whole valleys of pine trees, and they were turning red for a while, and now they're gray, and they're standing firewood. The government invited logging companies to come in and take as much as they could while it could still be run through mills. They probably took a quarter of a half of a percent of what's out there. And so we're looking at a couple of decades of super fires here. And so I really feel for the people of California. I know what people there are going through. And from Northern California, within smoke distance of the campfire and the former town of Paradise, we've been speaking with radio host Mariah Gallardon. Thank you, Mariah, and I hope to talk to you again, hopefully, in better times.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.